Word Jam.
Start at the beginning.
The rains. First, there were the most delicate rivulets, Sandra. They were just beautiful filaments of water systems running through the lawn behind the house. Our cat Oscar wanted nothing to do with them, but your aunt and I would stand at the window with our binoculars and zoom into the lawn to marvel at the abstract liquid patterns as they spread and eventually, following weeks of rainstorm, formed something of a small creek, months later becoming the river you now raft along in summer and paddle along in our canoe as you did today. After all this time, we can't imagine living without the ability to canoe right up to the backyard deck. But we haven't forgotten when there was an acre of grass and gardens there. Which leads me to today's lesson, and Uncle's ramblings of yet more useless chatter. Learn to see what was there when you venture out, dear niece. Even in the city, look at the surface and see the past. Be like the geologist and you won't go wrong. When your aunt and I go to Port Orlando to purchase goods, we see the ghosts of shops now gone. There was Star Tofu in the International District, a family business run by a Japanese couple who took pride in their handmade fresh tofu every single day for many decades. You'd never see it now. It's vanished entirely. Your aunt and I give that storefront a nod and a remembrance whenever we pass in front of the Vietnamese pho restaurant that currently inhabits Star's old space. I'm sure our fellow pedestrians figure we're batty. There was Mergenthaler's Haberdashery in West Port Orlando, where I always bought my pants. A shop that wouldn't let you out the door if anything wasn't absolutely perfect. And Mr. Mergenthaler's word was golden. If he said your slacks would be cuffed and ready by Tuesday at noon, they'd be ready. And he'd send you out the door with a recommendation for a gripping book suitable just for your current situation. Now that spot is one of those corporate coffee chains that pretend to care. Shiny, soulless places that are all logo and image but got no heart. I hope that Hank got a pretty penny when they bought him out, but you have to doubt that he did well. Last word I got, the cigars caught up with him, and the coffee cake caught up with his wife Miriam, bless them both. They practically lived at that shop, and by their pure sweat and persistence, they put their son Lonnie through Princeton, their daughter Valerie through Stanford. I won't go into that slick coffee shop. By all rights, there ought to be a large bronze plaque affixed to the brick wall beside the front doors in honor of those folks, but there isn't one. I'd shit a brick. I'd pass a poodle if even one of those look-alike kids behind the counter knew what the space had been. Yesterday? Yesterday isn't on their radar. One day we'll all be yesterday, Sandy. Even you. There were gardens back there. Right under this river, there were prize-winning heirloom tomatoes in summer and perfect autumn pumpkins. Your aunt's velvety black tulips were a rarity the neighbors called a miracle. Remember that. When you cut through the water in our cedar boat, look down and imagine purple cabbages and white garlic flowers. We appreciate the groceries, dear girl, especially the fresh bread from Frogger's. If you think of it, tell Susan her Portuguese egg bread is to die for. Margaret and I don't miss an afternoon of a pot of Earl Grey tea and their golden toast with butter and the local jam of the season. Please tell her that. Be sure to tie up the canoe in the usual spot in the boathouse and take the paddles with you if you would, darling. and don't let the rains get to you. The rains come, and they wear away and polish the stones, and their relentless small hammers create these channels of the past, the present, and the future for you and the ducks, dear niece.
Turn over. Start at the beginning.
I realized how far away we were from the present generation when my niece Sandy asked, "Really? How long could the wind last?" Imagine such a question. She and her friends had no knowledge at all of the 40-year wind. Educators teach them absolutely nothing about their history and what passes for schools these days, and the children go around blithely, innocently, and sometimes ignorantly, thinking that the wind always dies down quickly. I can hardly blame them, I suppose. That's all they've ever known. For someone like Marjorie and me, though, the generation shaped by the 40-year wind, the generation that wore its hair back in a sweep to accommodate it, the generation that still walks, either tilted forward or backward, from habit of making one's way in 40 to 70 mile per hour winds, we feel that the children know nothing of what it means to resist a constant force. They seem to us unprepared for the inevitable harsh weather that blows out the power, leaving humans huddled together in the dark. So it is for Sandra that I relate this explanation, this answer to her question. The wind is on record as having blown for 40 years, from October 13th of 1968 to June 7th of 2008, dear niece. Sandra, dear girl, there was a wind that arose, coiling its way down from the polar cap, a very strong and cold wind that explains so very much about your uncle and aunt and the way we look, the ways we talk, and all those behaviors that your generation finds strange and humorous. We've seen you mocking our walk, and sometimes on Halloween, imitating our coiffures. That means our hairstyles, darling. Even our language could be full of wind at times, but we were made strong by the bitter, relentless currents that forced us to shout to be heard and that built strong muscles from having to push against such a cruel polar airstream. Look at your aunt's beautiful calves and powerful thighs. They didn't get that way from strolling in a gentle breeze. I make no claims for my own physique, but I'm sure that my heart is stronger, even if my hearing has suffered, from those 40 years lived in the best and worst days and nights of my stormy life. Sandra, this is no old person's tale of walking miles in the snow each morning to get to school. There was no official school for four decades, dearest. I know that to your ears that seems delightful, but believe me, we hungered for knowledge. So we invented our own kinds of schools. Education collectives was what we called them. Each neighborhood of children gathered at the largest house within a half-mile radius of the greatest number of children. The parents and older adolescents brought books, magazines, vinyl records, all varieties of tape cassettes, videotapes, DVDs, CDs, computers of all vintages, strange collections of electronics and digital devices, and so many kinds of useful and/or historical tools. Though we didn't garden outside, we did invent greenhouses that could hold up to the freezing gusts from the north. So horticulture became a popular subject among us as it served to feed us in those trying times and provided melancholy remnants of prior green days. We stared longingly at photographs of outside gardens, wondering what it could have been like in those seasons of spring flowers and summer vegetation. This must sound fantastic to you, Sandra, but I promise you, if anything, I am underplaying the hardships. You now take for granted what we dreamed of in our fantasies of a perfect world. You couldn't know. We wouldn't want you to know it firsthand, and we pray that such winds never visit us again. But there were lessons learned, and those lessons we hope will not ever be lost, my dear girl. Margaret and I know that what we have learned seems useless to you. All the more reason for us to relate it. Before the wind, everyone was like you, dear girl. Let that sink in for a moment. Before the winds, no person really expected 40 years of leafless trees, of petalless flowers, of having to shout to be heard over the screaming Arctic forces that descended. And now you, little Sandy, our precious girl, you also go about without a single thought that the wind might arrive and unexpectedly not depart, without an inkling that the winds of the very spirit of changes you and your generation could be absolutely blown away by. Margaret and I are old now. The world is yours. Go into it erect and confident, Sandy. But know that the wind is always in the wings. And if it comes this time, it might never depart.
Turn over and start at the end.
Fire. To say the fire began unexpectedly is beyond redundancy. All unintentional fires that aren't arson begin unexpectedly. And this tragic blaze was not arson, nor did we intend it, dear niece. Yet, there were unusual circumstances, ones that raised the hair on our necks. Your aunt and I were cleaning up after a first-rate lunch of fresh tagliatelle pasta and homemade bolognese sauce, lovingly spun from Margaret's creative fingers. The day couldn't have been more relaxed and uneventful. It was a quiet, meaningless Sunday. My belly was warm and full, and I felt the slightest sleepiness from indulgence in a second glass of a reasonably priced, very satisfactory bottle of Carmenere, a full-bodied Chilean red wine. The radio was on in the kitchen, but I was only half listening and daydreaming. I could have imagined the voice speaking in any one of seven languages I don't know or understand at all. The voice was English, a BBC news reporter. I at first imagined Margaret had turned the dial to a program featuring some peculiar form of Icelandic poetry, even though I haven't a clue what the Icelandic language might sound like. I was on my way to the couch for a nap, when I heard crackling sounds, like someone crushing aluminum foil at a distance. The windows were open, and I felt sure that the crackling had come traveling over the river in that peculiar way sound is transported a great distance over water. As I've stated, I expected nothing. There'd been no warnings of a Santa Ana-style wind or of hazardously dry conditions, quite the opposite. Our summer had been one of the wettest on record in recent years. If your aunt and I worried about anything, it was that the land in our region had reached its saturation point, and that the water might rise to flood levels. the way it had when our young river was created. Sandra, it was the oddest sensation when I first saw black smoke curling around in the currents beyond the open window. I thought I was seeing a black ghost, not spinning charcoal plumes from the clapboard siding in flames on the outside wall. In the other room, far away from me, Margaret called. The hairs on the back of my neck just stood on end. Are you all right? The hairs on the back of my neck had risen too, and I knew that we were sharing one of those critical moments in life. When time temporarily halts and one's eyes open wide. The survival mechanism kicks in because careful logical consideration of the circumstances is too slow. Fire moves, well, like fire. And in the most fundamental depths of our flesh, where we beasts are intimately connected to everything, there is an override function that kicks in and leaps beyond any delineations we might name or consciously influence. The time-space continuum cracks, splinters, crumbles, evaporates, or goes up in smoke when sudden dire conditions threaten essential life force. My body went into automatic as my eyes observed my actions, dear girl. Can you grasp what I'm telling you? I know that someone on the outside observing my actions would have seen nothing unusual. I moved quickly and efficiently, with supernormal clarity, to pull Margaret to the back of the house, and I called the emergency number for our fire department. A massive army of rising black ghosts swirled around the house, and several black ghosts swooped in through the open window and flew across the ceiling, trailing their sooty arabesques. I pulled Margaret by her wrist to the dinghy off the porch, you know, the one with the blistering gray paint, and I paddled us to shore with no more than the clothes on our back and $27 in my pocket. Sandy. At absolute zero, theoretically the coldest temperature imaginable, all atoms come to a stop. At that point, I have to wonder what meaning cold or hot could have. Consider that at the center of a fire, burn victims have reported, the hot torture can reach a magnitude just before one passes out that feels like a freezing flame. When asked by his students what he saw as he burned at the stake, his body wrapped in a Torah scroll, Rabbi Hananya ben Taradu answered that as the parchment burned, the letters flew up to the heavens. Sandra, I don't know why I'm telling you this, or why when I see you I feel compelled to say these things when we'd all be better off if I just close my mouth and smile. In either case, silent or babbling on, I fear I appear like an old idiot. Your aunt and I care for you, dearest. I hope you know that you're the daughter we never had. I've no one else to tell these things, and no one else to whom I might confess my final wishes. You see, your aunt isn't as realistic about the end as we are, dear girl. When the time comes, she just won't be able to deal with it. She can't imagine me gone, much less cremated and reduced to ashes in an urn. When the house burned down, consuming most of our prized possessions in its flames, family photos, paintings by friends, and mementos from our world travels, we were devastated, but we moved on. Even in a peculiar way, felt the burden of our past lifted. Then we built this new house on the very foundation of our last one. When my body is consumed in the crematorium's flames, Sandra, please remember that I didn't remain silent in this flammable existence. and ask yourself why I chose to speak. Given that I knew, at the end of my days, this body would surely burn.
Word jam.